This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
There's one issue that has never been talked about in the House of Commons, not once. I checked. And that's generative AI. Now, many of you, this is the Cassandra moment. I'll go, oh, she's going to talk about the robots here. If you have not heard of something called ChatGPT, it was released last week. I ask you to Google it. Google ChatGPT. This is an AI that doesn't just regurgitate human speech. It parses and can nuance and come up with its own type of thought. This is here. This is creating massive waves. And in the next year, likely in the next year, it will displace lawyers. You can just ask the thing to write up a contract for you and any country's jurisprudence. It can come up with interpret legal rulings. It writes its own code.
That was Conservative MP Michelle Rempel-Garner on the floor of the House of Commons less than 10 months ago, citing generative AI for the very first time in debate. It's been a dizzying stretch since the launch of ChatGPT, with artificial intelligence regulation and policy bursting forward as a top concern in Canada and around the world. From a Canadian perspective, Bill C-27, which has definitely not moved quickly, got most of its initial attention for its privacy provisions, but its inclusion of an AI bill, AIDA, has emerged as a huge issue in its own right. Meanwhile, the government has also been quietly pushing ahead with new generative AI guidelines that may debut as soon as the day after this podcast is released. Bianca Wiley is a writer and open government and public technology advocate with a dual background in technology and public engagement. She may be best known to many for her advocacy on the sidewalk smart city issue in Toronto, where she was the most visible and effective critic of that initiative and the process behind it. She's become increasingly uncomfortable with the AI regulatory process in Canada, and she joins me on the podcast to provide her thoughts about AIDA, generative AI regulation, and a process that she believes is in dire need of fixing. Bianca, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Michael.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. You know, we've known each other for some time. In fact, I think it was really a front row seat seeing you in action during the entire sidewalk waterfront Toronto issue, where you were a leading voice in raising concerns and community awareness. And you have to say, having seen a lot of your presentations and your efforts in that regard, because I was on the Digital Strategy Advisory Panel for Waterfront Toronto as part of that, it always struck me that a big part of your concern revolved around process-related issues. You know, there were lots of different things that came out as part of that process, the social concerns, what technology was doing, democracy, whether or not government was being sufficiently accountable and transparent. A lot of those things weren't being accounted for, but a lot of it was, you know, it's the process that we've set up that kind of, in a sense, bakes in a lot of these concerns. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to bring you in, not to talk specifically about the sidewalk waterfront Toronto issue. If people are interested in that, they can apparently go see a play right now in Toronto in which there's a character that plays you, but rather to talk about AI policymaking in Canada. Because I think we see many of the same kinds of issues and concerns there. We can focus a bit on substance, but it's especially process both around AIDA, Bill C-27, and an effort that has not got much of attention, in part because the government hasn't given much attention, on establishing generative AI guardrail policies, which as we record this, my understanding is may come out in just the next number of days, actually, perhaps within a day or two after this podcast drops. Anyway, bit of an introduction. Why don't we start with AIDA? I've already had some podcasts that focus on the substance, but maybe you can get us started by providing a bit of an introduction to the bill, the way you might try to introduce someone who is thinking about AI regulation in Canada for the first time.
Yeah, certainly. And I was so happy to join you today, because a lot of my thinking on this, exactly to your point, is about process with AIDA and AI and democracy and public engagement. And I also think that as someone who doesn't, you know, engage with tons of federal laws, I've had some questions really at a high level on legislative process and the structure of this bill. So I'm curious to get some of your thoughts back on some of my observations. It took me a while to realize that a good starting point, if I were to talk to somebody about what's going on with this, would be 2017. because in 2017, the Ministry of Innovation, Science, and Economic Development launched the Pan-Canadian AI Strategy. And I think it's important for all of us to acknowledge that the work of whatever, you know, regulation or however the thinking around this is going at the current moment was really born. Now we're into the fifth year of the federal government taking public money and investing it in both the research and commercialization of AI. And so ICID, who is the one who drafted this bill, has really and continues to have a mandate to increase the uptake of the use of AI across all sectors of Canadian society, and also to support Canadian AI companies. And I think that that's really critical, because if you forget that that's where a lot of these conversations started, you might lose the frame, which is that we've got the ministry that is responsible and mandated for the uptake and growth of this industry now putting forward concerns about the uptake and growth of this industry. So there's a bit of a closed circuit there. So I think, one, that's an important piece of history. Two, I think, and this was evident to me in the sidewalk conversations, is that AI as a term, and I don't want to devolve too far into this, but it's not an accessible term for people. If you say to someone, you know, let's talk about AI, or even if you start to talk about automation, it's not something a lot of people feel is within their comfort zone to talk about. And that generally makes it feel like people can't weigh in, because even take myself, I've been reading a lot about this in the past year and a half, and I would not, you know, profess to be an expert in artificial intelligence or machine learning. So what that does is it puts a chill on the general public, and it really opens up the opportunity for the narrative or the rhetoric to take hold, and for people to sort of sit back and say, okay, well, this is how, okay, I'm being told this is how it works. I'm being told this is what's dangerous, without a lot of personal experience, because it's not being talked about in words that are accessible. So on that front, I really try to talk about AI or machine learning as, firstly, AI being a marketing term. And secondly, that really pattern matching, you know, historical patterns, using historical patterns, lots of data to predict future events or to create things from the past. So pattern matching, I find, is at least somewhat accessible to people. And I think that the last thing I'll say about how I try to begin conversations on this, one of my favorite touch points is Ursula Franklin's Massey Lectures, 1989, The Real World of Technology. She makes a really compelling argument that public participation needs to be increased in technology matters, not just because of the public investment, not just because of the consequences and the general idea that that's a good idea for democracy, but really because technology influences our culture. You know, like, it really starts to change and shift things as to how we really the shape of our day, how we do things, how our workplaces operate, how our relationships are intermediated. And I think that that history of awareness that we need more public engagement in this topic, if that was 1989, you go 10 years forward and you get to Janice Gross Stein, who is waving red flags all over the place about efficiency being far too dominant, a cultural touch point. And I just think if you look at that, that's, you know, more than 20 years ago, we haven't really addressed those problems and made it so that people can engage on this topic. So when we're looking at ADA and we're looking at what do we want to do to regulate AI, I don't think we're starting from any sort of a place where the general public could even participate thoughtfully if they wanted to. And that to me is a problem, big problem.
No, and I want to come back to that process issue. Some instances they may not be able to, the language may not be accessible and the like. In some instances, they may not even be invited to participate. And we can come to that in a moment. I want to focus on that process, but before we do that, you have identified some of the concerns from a substantive perspective. So, you know, this isn't just a concern about saying, hey, you didn't listen to enough people. It's also concerns about at least what the output is. I want to focus on how we got to that output, but what are some of the concerns that you have with this bill that is probably worth noting is included within a broader privacy bill within C-27. So it meshes together both privacy and AI. And it hasn't moved quickly through the House, but there is a lot of expectation that it will be subject to hearings in the fall. So it seems to finally be starting to move legislatively in Ottawa.
So, yeah, and I really will limit my sort of substance and content concerns. And they're still more structural than really getting too far into the technical. But I think the first one, and this maybe even sounds a bit philosophical, but I don't feel good about the overarching approach that's being taken with AI, where it's being treated like an object that is, it's like, well, here's a box of AIs. Let me take one out and see if it's safe or see if it's working well. If you look at the ways that systems, such as those that there's a lot of infrastructure that is required to have an artificial intelligence product or service in play. And the way that any automation really plays out in society is through an ecosystem. You know, it's more like how does AI function in a particular context? I'm going to give you a specific example. I don't think this is perfect, but I've heard some people say, hey, we need to regulate AI because look, we had to regulate cars. So let's look at cars. Cars are highly regulated. At the same time, people are dying daily. Lots of people are dying daily because of cars. And if you think about that, it's often because we're not looking at the context in which or the ecosystem around the way cars are used. So you can regulate something as an object, but it can still have so many different impacts and negative impacts that only become visible when you look at the product or service in context and use in its environment. So I think firstly, the idea that we're talking about something so abstract and so general, I feel like it's this discussion is floating away from the groundedness of any specific context, whether you would look at labor, whether you would look at, you know, research, whether you would look at medical treatment. Like you can go across every sector of society, and if you look at it in that specific context, ecosystem, relationships, you know, the actors involved, you're going to have vastly different kinds of conversations, education, like I could go on. So firstly, I don't think that the way that looking at AI as though it's a thing absent all of the ecosystem and all of the relationships and responsibilities around it is sound. That's one big problem. I think secondly, the idea that there is very specific harms, and we need to focus entirely on, you know, you've probably heard some of the catastrophic fears, or like, you know, these things going to take over and be automating very dangerous situations where a human should be making a decision rather than a machine. I think what happens there is that you go in very narrow and look at a tiny set of cases. And what you don't do is look at the broad ways that you can use automation and cause harms or cause cultural change. And that's these kinds of technologies, they're seeping into every public and private sector domain imaginable. And I think that that's something that the consequence of that gets back to Ursula Franklin's thinking, where labor, I think, is a great example. If something like AI is going to fundamentally change what decent work looks like, because there's a push to automate even what seemed like banal or administrative function, that is a major consequence that is not being touched here. And so I think what happens when you have this like really intense focus on what are seen as like high risk or future dangerous scenarios, you miss the majority of the field, which is current and existing harms and all the kinds of things that are harmful in a broader context, but you don't have a line of sight to unless you're talking in specifics. I think the final one structurally that is a problem is the oversight that is proposed in ADA is really a closed circuit of ICED again, where there's, you know, looking to set up a new sort of oversight regime, and that's all going to happen downstream of the minister within ICED. If your mandate is both to increase the use of this technology and then be curtailing its use when it is dangerous, that's not technically for me. You don't need to know about AI to understand that from a governance perspective, something there is really off. And so that proposal that somehow we need to invent, you know, new institutional power, and downstream of that comes industries, they're going to start to, you know, is this fair? Is this ethical? Is this responsible AI? I think all of that can get quite distracting from that higher order question, which I would have hoped someone who is an expert in legislation would have looked at this proposal that is currently in ADA and thought, no, that's a non-starter. That's not how you set up any kind of responsible, accountable governance structure. So those are three that, you know, bubble up to me in terms of a problematic approach. I just want to say it's not to say that we don't need to think about regulating general purpose technologies, but the way that it is being proposed here, to me, several red flags.
Okay. That's interesting. Now, I guess for me, what follows from that is, as you identify some really big picture concerns, at times I'll have of people on that will focus on specific provisions and or the lack thereof when it comes to this. And certainly the governance side or that piece is one that has come up before, but you've identified a number of other concerns. So to what extent do you think that's a function of process? What do we know about how Ada came to be? What kind of consultation was there? Was it in your mind, based on what we know, that some of the shortcomings that you believe are there are a function of how the government's gone about trying to create this in the first place?
Yeah, so from I was surprised when I saw Ada appear because we know if we go back a few years, there was a broad federal public consultation, and not to say that that was even great, but it did occur to think about issues related to this digital charter concept. But specific conversations with the public, but writ large, did not happen specific to AI. So that LAP never happened. Then we had ICE had set up this AI Advisory Council. Now, its remit was to grow trust in the use of AI, and its remit was to get people thinking, how might we use this productively because this is a good idea for the Canadian economy. So the one group that sort of had a bit of a mandate to engage with the public was doing it more as a marketing exercise than really as a place to try to draw out the kind of conversation that you need to have where there can be opposing views and that you would surface challenges and problems, and not just the sort of headline issues. But you would need to be sharing with people that deep privatization and centralization of power in terms of the infrastructures that a lot of this technology relies on. You'd really have to do a pretty significant amount of education to even have those conversations. The AI Advisory Council did not undertake that. And they even have in their one report that what they started to talk about with the public was really just scratching the surface, like needed to be returned to. So even within the group that ICID may be thinking was part of any kind of public discussion, has itself said this is not in any way fulsome. So we've got lack of general public consultation. We've got whatever the advisory council process is. We've got I think that the third piece of this is why I raised the 2017 Pan-Canadian AI strategy, is that if you look at the mandate, and this isn't to say that ICID's mandate to support and grow Canadian AI, the industry, is a problem unto itself. I'm not saying that, but I would think that ICID would be aware that the issues that are being raised now, the remit is far broader than their own. So I think the fact that ICID is the drafter of a bill that is now talking about everything from human rights concerns to culture to democracy, I would have thought someone within Minister Champagne's office would say, you know what? We're talking about a lot of things that are far beyond our mandate. It would probably make sense to start to work across government and to start to bring in other participants and, other ministries. I think labor, to me, continues to be just an absolutely wild omission, given the consequence to this kind of automation to both what decent work looks like and to the economy. So I think we don't have any of the historical evidence here that any sort of groundwork was done properly. And then you add on the fact that the mandate is not the right mandate if you're going to talk about human rights issues. This is not ICID's world. So those to me are three big problems with how we got here. And then I think the final thing to layer in is to remember we are still, yes, it's not a WHO defined emergence anymore, but we have been through crisis years. We're still in a bad place. There's a lot of conversation about productivity, the economy, and there is a global push right now to make AI the next place for capital to go. There is a desire to see this industry grow and expand. And if you look at what some of the international, some of Canada's peers are doing, they're also doing similar things to what Canada is doing. But as far as I can tell, Canada has not done its groundwork to be this sort of urgent rush to head over, to the G7 and say, hey, we want in, we want to harmonize globally with everyone because Canada hasn't talked to its people, but it's showing up and sort of saying, all right, let's tag in with what everyone else here is doing. And that is incoherent with Minister Champagne saying, oh, we need to make sure we're supporting Canadian values. It's like, well, what does that even mean here? You haven't checked in on those values in this context.
Yeah, no, there has been I think most would say a lack of conversation, to be sure, around some of this stuff. Now we did see a push to try to move this bill forward back, I guess, in the spring of this year. You know, when it was first introduced, most of the attention, I think, was on the privacy side, and that has gradually shifted. And I think personally, as someone who spends a lot of time on the privacy side, I think it's a big problem that if you literally get 5 minutes before committee, and now you 5 minutes alone is not a ton, and then to have to now choose, am I going to talk about AI or I'm going to talk about privacy? That alone suggests that one or the other is just going to get short shrift. There's almost no way around it. But we did see earlier this year a bit of a letter writing campaign, kind of almost out of nowhere, in support of the bill, saying, you know, this was super urgent. And it was at a time, obviously, when ChatGPT was getting a lot of attention. It came and went pretty quickly, but it's clear it was backed by some of the pretty big names in the AI space in Canada, including led by, I think, Yoshio Bengio. You know, what were some of your thoughts? I mean, is this sort of a piece with those kind of broader concerns that you have certain voices that are driving this and many others that aren't even aware that it's taking place, much less being consulted?
Yeah, I mean, my thoughts when I saw that letter is just it's a thought that's been persistent, which is there's an absolutely disturbingly small set of people that are informing and influencing national policy and law. I mean, small, like far, far too small. If you put the topics being discussed beside the number of people being engaged in the discussion, it's it's one of those things you look at and you think, I would feel uncomfortable if I was standing up and saying, oh, with great confidence, this is what we have to do, as like such a tiny number of people. And I think it's not to my mind that the people who are, whether it's Benji or others, I think their concerns, I genuinely think they are concerned about the speed with which some of the technology is accelerating, which is something they're doing themselves. But the idea that they can't see that they have zero expertise in policy creation or in democracy, as far as I understand. And so I am concerned that ICED, or Minister Champagne specifically, is really just sort of following along a narrative that is deeply, deeply vested in the expansion and uptake of these technologies. Like it's way too closed a circuit. And I think something else that tips me off, when the people who want regulation are coming from every side. So the government wants regulation, the development community wants regulation, the critics within the tech industry want regulation. There's also something disturbing when the entire conversation is so closed and tight that it's like there's only one thing on the table here. And I just from a perspective of what good process looks like. We know if you look at the history of democracy and policy and law, there has to be friction. There have to be trade-offs. There has to be, disagreement or space for different positions. And I think what's happened here is you've got such a tiny number of people that, frankly, for me, there's some sort of maybe it's because I worked in facilitation and I understood what it was to say what I think does not matter. This process is to facilitate a conversation that is broader. I don't see any sort of humility here in terms of understanding that there are enormous different types of consequences that, like, they're not even on the table. And I'm just going to keep going back to labor and culture. They would reorient this discussion and the regulatory approach entirely. So when that came out, the things that really come to mind is the closeness and the sort of just tiny, close-knit, very closed circuit set of people that are driving this agenda. And secondly, there's absolutely inadequate amounts of diversity and friction in the conversation, even coming from critics, because critics are, even in the best of times, still vested in this thing being important. There are just not adequate, there is just inadequate representation from way too many places. And I would have thought that a minister in the government would be able to look at this and say, you know what? This is too narrow. This is too narrow. This is not the way that you lead or design process to make sure that we're actually thinking about this expansively.
Well, if AIDA feels narrow, get a load of the work on generative AI, which is in a sense a subset from this government on this issue. So, as you know, and some listeners may know, over the summer, there was a generative AI document sort of designed to establish some guardrails, a non-binding document, but essentially trying to establish a bunch of principles. It wasn't made public, but it was the existence of this consultation was inadvertently, we think, posted on a Government of Canada consultation website. I tweeted about it. It started to get a bit of attention. And what we know is that the government held series of meetings. They added at least one additional meeting. Those meetings are all Chatham House rules. In other words, you can talk about what was discussed, but you can't attribute it to any individual. There's no list of participants anywhere. And as I mentioned off the top, it's my understanding that the results of all of that are going to be published as here's our guidelines or our guardrails in a matter of days. It's basically kind of come and gone. Mm-hmm. You have thoughts, you know, in the aftermath of the kinds of concerns you've been expressing, and you're certainly not the only one. There were many people that looked at AIDA and said, listen, we need privacy law. Can we stick with that lane? And we've got a whole series of concerns about how this AI bill came about, much less some of the substance in it. Can we hit the reset button here and do so and really kind of start over? And yet, far from starting over, actually advancing on this particular issue and doing so, frankly, in a more secretive way. You have any thoughts about some of that work on trying to develop these kind of standards or guardrails around generative AI?
Yeah, I mean, it really just feels like Minister Champagne and I said, it's just doubling down. Like the critique is persistent. There's an obvious problem here, both structurally and in terms of lack of process. And then there's just more coming like here. And I think two main concerns. One of them, doing these kinds of closed sessions is just not obviously even confidence inspiring, but it's also the content and the process within them. If you can't access it, and if you do, and I'm sure we'll see more detail here, you look at AIDA, it's 18 pages of vagary, and that is by design. I don't know what's going to happen with this code of practice or generative AI discussions, but again, there's something really incoherent about the argumentation that I just want to focus on. On one hand, there appears to be these really specific deep fake, or, you know, like you'll see ICID mentioned, these are concerns that we have and we need to respond urgently. And then when you look at the content of what is being put forward, it is absolutely in the abstract. And so ICID is not doing, it's funny because these closed meetings, I'd say, are one piece of the puzzle that is bad process. But I would say even more tellingly, and this is where it gets really problematic to me, is they're doing most of what they're doing pretty much like wide open in terms of publishing. They wrote a companion document and it explicitly says part of why we're rushing here is to signal to the industry that they're not going to get really hemmed in too far or punished for working in this area. And you think, really, this is our concern? If this is our concern, let's just talk about wanting to develop the industry. But there's this incoherence here with we need to move fast because we have specific dangerous issues emerging. And then you turn to the documentation, the writing, the reports, the drafts, and there's nothing substantive there. So it just feels like we're using urgency, fear, concern to sort of like brew up the need to act. But then you look over at what the act is, and the act isn't anything. And it's not coming into effect until 2025. So I think the closed meetings, problem, always a problem. But just to go out further to their rationale and as it's being published, there's a really, to me, brazen sort of doing this broadly in public and kind of saying, no, this is inherently what we have to do to get this done. And these are the people we need to talk to. And they know, and you don't know. So just like, don't worry, you'll see that we're doing a good thing for you. It's got a bit of a paternalistic quality to it, the way that it comes off to me, to be honest. But don't like the closed meetings, never like those. Why would you have to do that? But more broadly, I think a little bit of this is what happens when you've been working on a topic since 2017 in a very, very closed culture, because it's just too long of stewing in your own thoughts of how important this technology is and how dangerous it is. Meanwhile, we've got so many existing harms, and we've got so many issues with, you know, legacy software or data misuse, and we've got issues that are not anywhere near the top of the pile, and they're being ignored. So I'm saying all of this because the rhetoric, the rationale, the like, look, it feels very performative, you know, like here's a code, here's a draft bill, we're going to do agile, and there's like all this flurry of activity. But when you hone in on what it is proposing, it's not clear.
Yeah, I mean, it's a super interesting observation that the government cites the urgency with these issues and some of the harms for the need to act quickly, but then doesn't really provide any sort of specifics, or all of that is to be determined later. So it provides the impetus to move quickly, but without actually proposing actually what to do about any of it, to say, well, we'll deal with the specifics kind of down the road. But of course, it's, you're driving the narrative based on an urgency that then isn't reflected in the legislative proposals themselves.
No, and just 2 points on that, because I think they're really important. One of them, and thank you for all the work on C18. I mean, I think one of my concerns with this particular bill is it's not the kind of thing where should it pass, and I hope the committee says no, and we'll talk about that, but I should it pass, the danger is that it won't do anything. It will entrench the status quo. So the missed opportunity here is a little bit unintuitive, because it's not like there's going to be some big event the next day. What it's actually going to be is all of the things that are going on are going to keep going on, because there's nothing in here that will definitively change that. So the opportunity here that we are missing is to actually intervene and significantly start to like turn the ship, which, if you think about digital charter and you think about the broader sense of, where people feel so like, well, this is all just inevitable, this is the future, this is just the next thing that's coming at us. This approach, it just sort of entrenches the current power dynamics. So I think like that's a significant problem, and it shows up a little bit differently, because it's almost like we have a moment in time here where we need to intervene pretty hard, and what we're seeing is the kind of proposal that has vagary, all over, and we'll figure it out after. Which brings me to my second point and a little bit of a question to you, which is, as far as I would think, I would hope ICED is one thing, but as far as I would imagine, there must be other parts of our institution, like the Department of Justice, for example, that would look at something like this and say, you know what? No, we don't just do the outline and then figure it out after. I mean, are there no, like, from a legislative safeguard perspective, even, I just have to say, like, this to me is quite concerning procedurally, that it could even be suggested that we're going to use, I mean, Michael, they're talking about agile. Agile is for software development. Like, law is not software code. So even the sort of like we're being innovative by leaving this loose and adaptive, I'm having a hard time understanding how the federal government thinks that that's something that we want to do with our legal process.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are elements here that the government wants to be seen to be doing something,
Yes.
and so it's doing something, even if that something is pretty nonspecific at this stage. There is, and you're right to highlight it, there is a problem, and I think it's reflected even in things like C11 and C18, where policies are very siloed. I remember actually when Trudeau government was first elected. They made a big thing about saying, we're bringing together cabinet ministers, and we're going to have those cabinet ministers are going to work together across departments. We're going to break down the silos that so often exist. It's pretty clear, a number of years later, that has not happened, and that in fact, whoever gets responsibility for a particular issue shepherds that bill through, and the ability to, in a sense, almost cross-pollinate policy across government becomes exceptionally difficult. That might happen a little bit, during some in the back room sort of thing or at cabinet, but once it's out there, there's one minister that typically has responsibility for that piece of legislation, and that's it. And so you don't get sort of all of those different perspectives brought to the table.
Right.
I will say, even with the limited amount, what would you say to people who say, listen, this is suboptimal. This is not the best. It's not great work. We could and we should be doing better, but other countries are moving forward really quick, are moving forward quickly on it. We've seen, for example, in generative AI, we've seen the Biden administration put out some guidelines. We're seeing Europe having more detailed regulation. And the argument would likely be that, if Canada stays on the sidelines at this moment, when some of the bigger countries and bigger forces are moving forward to develop those regulations, then effectively the decisions get made for us, that we live in a globalized environment, and there are some limits to how much Canada gets to choose for itself, how much any country gets to choose for itself. I mean, you can make those choices, but sometimes those choices will have consequences and you may exclude yourself altogether. And some might like that, but we do see a lot of the rulemaking, the standards, people moving quite quickly along those lines. And I think part of what the government would likely respond to some of the concerns about the way in which it's going about doing this is to say, listen, we're facing our own process, and it's a global process in which others who may have more power globally to establish these rules are setting those rules. And either we jump in to try to ensure some of our perspectives are represented, or basically it's handed to us a fait accompli.
Yeah, so I think this is a great time to zoom out, because this is a very real question, and it does relate to where global capitalism is at today. And I think, like, there's a great book I just finished. It's a long read, but it's called Palo Alto by Malcolm Harris, and it goes back to the beginning of Stanford University in 1850, and goes all the way forward to current day, and looks at Silicon Valley and technology and capitalism in specific. And one of the things that he talks about is the difference between economic nationalism and sort of international finance. And I think, to your point, and if we go back to Pipeta, so we're about 20 years out from that, the overarching intent was to harmonize the flow of data. That was the number one. And in this instance, it's, again, that argument around, like, international capital, which is what is driving the development and uptake and use of these technologies, wants harmonization. And I think, as happened 20 years ago, that is a lot of the government's rationale, is we have to follow along, and we don't have enough, you know, domestic power in order to, like, really reshape things. But for me, just because that is the way of the world, it doesn't mean that you sort of that you just don't try to figure out what is the economic nationalism conversation to have, or where are there particular points in time or moments or uses or considerations where we do step aside and say, hey, there's a reason that we have sovereignty. There's a reason that we do have different values in this country versus another country. I'm not saying that those are anywhere near universal in this country, but I think, pragmatically speaking, the pressure is coming from harmonization for international finance. That's there. But if that's the case, Michael, then let's have that conversation. Because what is so frustrating about trying to take part in this discussion is we're pretending that we need to hurry up because we're concerned about bias and human rights and all sorts of really, truly important issues, but those issues are not being given the space and time required. If we want to talk about what it looks like to work in Canada, what does a job look like? There are places where we should be thinking about this in terms of how do we build very specific, and it doesn't have to be law. You can't, you know, build the whole world in law. Like, I don't think anyone wants that. So I do think that as a bit of friction to the international harmonization of this capital flow, yes, we should be thinking about specific places where you do potentially refuse use, or you do say, no, in Canada, there's a few places where X, Y, Z, that's one piece of the puzzle. And also, this is why missing out on that broader conversation about culture, about labor, about the arts, about democracy, we should still be having those conversations and figuring out if and how we can influence what we want to see happen in this country. Because you're right that that's the pressure and that's why this is all happening. But the idea that we should all just keep staring at this train wreck, I mean, this is 30 years. Is there ever going to be a point in time where we say, oh, no, it does matter what we do here? Because it's not just about the market, or to say, oh, it's going to be so hard for capital to come here because Canada has, like, tough rules or X, Y, Z. Let's also remember, the AI industry is firstly dependent on a whole lot of infrastructure that is not Canadian, one. And two, let's also remember, it is a small, small piece of our broad economy. So I think I really have questions for, say, corporate lawyers that are working in a range of industries in Canada that would look at this legislation and say, you know what? This doesn't even help me manage the risks or the liabilities or any fiduciary responsibilities I have, because this thing is performance theater for us to just keep on playing with what the rest of the world is doing. So that's my thought there. I think, yes, this is a real reason this is going down this way. But also, if we never feel it's the right time to insert ourselves, we're just going to keep on this train that I think most people in Canada, if I say this with pretty strong degree of confidence, most people in Canada don't want to automate all these different components of our life and our society. So, like, is there ever a good time to have that conversation, or it's just like too bad, finance, capital, globally, you're in charge? I don't like the second option. And I don't think we should just say, okay, well, hands up. I don't think that's a good idea.
Yeah. Well, I'm so bad. I mean, I think people like a lot of the benefits that can come, and I think there are benefits that come from some of these technologies. And to me, one of the questions is, to what extent are people willing to basically sort of follow along with what you're suggesting, saying, okay, we may take a stand and we may decide to go without, because that's the choice we're making. I mean, we're seeing that play out a little bit now in the C18 context, where, you know, we've had some that say, well, we want mandated payments for links through this legislation, and we've got a government that's saying it's quite prepared basically to go without social news on social media, and potentially to go without news on search, and in taking that stand. And I do wonder, to what extent are people, once you are facing what might be viewed as a real sacrifice, or at least a loss of certain kinds of services or opportunities, are they willing to say, well, no, that's we're willing to pay that price for
Well,
legislation that reflects what other values that we've got?
I'm so glad you bring this up, because C18 to me is a face plant. Like, I really have a hard time understanding how there was never any more room to think about different ways to do the thing. So, in terms of how to support the journalism industry, or how to not entrench and just like hold up the power of the tech companies here, I think there could have been a lot of other ways to think about it. So to take that failure and error, I would call that whole process an outcome, over to this conversation with AI, it really gets back to that question where I said it might sound a little philosophical, but to me, it's not. You are not ever going to build safe, ethical, responsible AI, I'm making air quotes here, in the product. The way in which these tools, because to your point, might be used for beneficial purpose, is completely in how you surround them. What are the procedures? What are the responsibilities of the people using them? So it's not a binary, are we allowed to have this product or not? Because that thinking that you can make the product, that you can independently make a safe AI, this is not how technology works. The only way you can get to these beneficial uses and mitigate the bulk of the harms is investing in the people around them and in the processes around them. So to me, it's not about whether or not we'd be able to use certain products in Canada or not. What it is to say, if you're going to use product XYZ in Canada, here's how you do the implementation. If that implementation is too burdensome, then maybe we're going to run into different conversations. But I think that creates a great scratch test for any industry or any actor who wants to use these to say, is it worth it? Because if it's easy to just automate and a lot of the harms are understood as like, well, that doesn't work as well, or that wasn't a very human thing, but oh well, no big cost to my business. You can see that these will be applied, and there's going to be people who say, I don't care. That's a different experience for a customer. I don't care that there's no human available, or like that changes. But there's also going to be cases where, if in industry you see, you know what, if we want to use this, we also need to do this, this, and this, and that's expensive. And let me look back to what we're doing here. Is this even worth the investment? Those are the conversations that would help create responsible implementation. So I hope that is helpful when I'm trying to, I know it's abstract, but this idea of contextual integrity is fundamental. And I think what everybody is avoiding here, you have to invest in labor and process around the use of these products and services. They are never going to be standalone, good to go. That's just not how technology works. You can use it in so many different ways that that idea is folly. It's also why I don't like the idea that we're setting up an entire cottage industry that's going to pretend that you can figure out how to make something ethical in a product. Like, this is just not how those words work. And I think this is also why you can tell we've like hit a nerve here. All of these words getting co-opted and pulled into productization. Even privacy has been productized. Privacy is contextual. It's not something you can say to on the, it's not like the cereal box where you look on the side, yep, this is safe, responsible, privacy. Like, that's not how it is. But we've started to create that sense that you can do that. That's not how this works. So I don't think it's a question of making bars too high or banning stuff or like missing out in Canada. It's investing in the thoughtful ecosystem to support use. If it's beneficial and it's worth it, great. And if it's protected and safeguards are there, fantastic. Those are going to come from people. Is there a big push to invest more in labor right now? No, which is why we have to be so careful with implementation. And it's why this level of abstraction for a bill, we're talking in House of Cards world here with words that don't map to what they mean. You can't do responsibility absent people. You can't do ethics absent people. You can't write that into statistics. It's not how it goes.
Okay, let me try to move it from that that sort of abstract higher level and conclude with sort of the practical reality of where things are at. So we've got a generative AI code that, as I say, likely to be introduced a few, within a day or two, frankly, after this podcast drops, sometime in the next number of days. We've got hearings on AIDA that are likely to go to committee within a number of weeks as well. So, the government is certainly marching on. What do you think we should do? How do we best respond to some of the concerns that you've raised? Because as it stands now, it sure feels like this bill's marching ahead. There'll be a limited number, similar kind of circles, limited number of people that ultimately get to appear. Many of them might not even talk about AI regulation because they'll be focused on something else. And before we know it, we'll hear about how there were extensive hearings and it's time to move on. So do you have any prescription or solutions for what comes next or what ought to come next?
Well, I think at committee, I hope the MPs that are sitting on that committee are looking at this AIDA piece of it and having a sense of, I don't want to hold this back. Do I think this is likely? No. But what I'm saying is, as they're arriving into and looking at this and looking at so many people have shared thoughts and concerns and critiques, that they would say, from a pragmatic perspective, this would not come into effect until 2025, which means we can probably just go back on it, vote no at committee, reroute this elsewhere, figure out how to start again, and still end up on the same timeline. So I think there is a very reasonable, rational, defensible decision to make to say no to this thing at committee. I think that's one thing. And I think that should it continue along and there's all of these amendments that are being proposed, and those are all harm reduction mitigation efforts to try to do something better with this, people are going to have to stay really engaged to try to keep forcing friction and ongoing process to try to, drive this thing down to the ground of context, of different sectoral approaches, looking at how this may or may not play out or be beneficial or harmful in very specific cases across sectors. Because I just don't want anyone to think that they're getting any kind of safety or protection because something like this is moving through committee. And I think for those members, I don't think we should be using law as a press release to say hey, we're doing something. I think at some point someone needs to be responsible for what's happening here on from a legislative perspective. And I think the last thing I'll say, because as you mentioned, there's a significant amount going on with the privacy bill. And I think I could be wrong for sure, wrong about lots, but in this case, it may be helpful to have these two things beside each other in committee because and I was speaking to Brenda McPhail about this, and she just shared something with me that was so helpful to think about, where privacy, when you say this is a privacy bill, a lot of us can look at that concept and then take it downstream and say, okay, does this protect this? Does this enhance this? Does this harm this? If you try to move over and then point at, and you just say artificial intelligence, artificial intelligence, what? What are we trying to accomplish here? And it doesn't make sense. And I think I'll end by saying, Michael, because I didn't say this, I think one of the biggest losses in not doing a public consultation process is that if you were to take AIDA and its thinking out to the general public and try to make it make sense to people who are not deeply embedded in different vested interests around this, it would unravel itself. That is how closed and narrow and it has not been subject to any kind of rigorous conversation. And so having the kind of process that would put it in concert with, as you mentioned, so many of these other siloed laws and tech issues would help us really take a crack at the kind of conversations that are expansive and might make something more coherent even across the different laws. So I think that's another benefit of, regardless what happens here, someone's got to get us having that broader, longer conversation so we can start to turn the ship to have more public power and agency driving this, and make sure that we just keep at it. We just have to be sanding the gears here and create friction.
Right. Well, you certainly have been one of the most outspoken people for having those kinds of conversations. And I agree with you. I think we're falling short in that regard. I love that notion of law as a press release. Thank you for the work that you've been doing to raise awareness on this and on a number of other areas more broadly on tech. And thank you so much for coming on and joining me on the podcast.
Likewise. Thanks for all your work, Michael. Thanks for having me.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod or Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.